the manuscript is to be believed. The title of the manuscript, Latres Sainti Trinisophi, translated into English means the Most Holy Trinisophia or the Most Holy Three-fold Wisdom. The title itself opens a considerable field of speculation. Is there any connection between Latres Sainti Trinisophi and the Masonic Brotherhood of Lay Trinisophists, which was founded in 1805 by the distinguished Belgian Freemason and mystic Jean-Marie Ragon, already referred to? The knowledge of occultism possessed by Ragon is mentioned in terms of the highest respect by H.P. Blavatsky, who says of him that for 50 years he studied the ancient mysteries wherever he could find accounts of them. Is it not possible that Ragon as a young man either knew Street Germain or contacted his secret society? Ragon was termed by his contemporaries the most learned Mason of the 19th century. In 1818, before the Lodge of Lay Trinisophists, he delivered a course of lectures on ancient and modern initiation, which he repeated at the request of that lodge in 1841. These lectures were published under the title Cours philosophique et interpretation et modernis. In 1853 Ragon published his most important work Orthodoxie Masique. Ragon died in Paris about 1866, and 2 years later his unfinished manuscripts were purchased from his heirs by the Grand Orient of France for 1,000 francs. A high Mason told Madame Blavatsky that Ragon had corresponded for years with two Orientalists in Syria and Egypt, one of whom was a Copt gentleman. Ragon defined the Lodge of the Trinisophists as those who study three sciences. Madame Blavatsky writes, "It is on the occult properties of the three equal lines or sides of the triangle that Ragon based his studies and founded the famous Masonic Society of the Trinisophists." Ragon describes the symbolism of the triangle in substance as follows. The first side or line represents the mineral kingdom, which is the proper study for apprentices. The second line represents the vegetable kingdom, which the companions should learn to understand, because in this kingdom generation of bodies begins. The third line represents the animal kingdom, from the exploration of which the master mason must complete his education. It has been said of the Lodge of the Trinisophists that it was at one time the most intelligent society of Freemasons ever known. It adhered to the ancient landmarks but gave clearer and more satisfactory interpretations to the symbols of Freemasonry than are afforded in the symbolical lodges. In the third, candidates for initiation received a philosophic and astronomic explanation of the Hieramic legend. The Egyptianized interpretation of Freemasonic symbolism, which is so evident in the writings of Ragon and other French Masonic scholars of the same period, such as Court de Gabelin and Alexander Lenoir, is also present in the figures and text of the Street Germain manuscript. In his comments on the Rite of Misraim, called the Egyptian Rite, Ragon distinguishes 90 degrees of Masonic mysteries. The 1st to 33rd degrees he terms symbolic, the 34th to 66th degrees, philosophic, the 67th to 77th, mystic, and the 78th to 90th, Kabbalistic. The Egyptian Freemasonry of Cagliostro may also have been derived from Street Germain or from some common body of Illuminists of whom Street Germain was the moving spirit. Cagliostro's memoirs contain a direct statement of his initiation into the Order of Knights Templars at the hands of Street Germain. Deluche gives what a modern writer on Cagliostro calls a fantastic account of the visit paid by Alessandro and his wife the Comtesse Felicitas to Street Germain in Germany, and their subsequent initiation by him into the sect of the Rosicrucians, of which he was the Grand Master or Chief. There is nothing improbable in the assumption that Cagliostro secured Latres Sainti Trinisophi from Street Germain, and that the manuscript is in every respect an authentic ritual of this society. The word Trinisophi quite properly infers a triple meaning to the contents of the book, in other words that its meaning should be interpreted with the aid of three keys. From the symbolism it seems that one of these keys is alchemy, or soul, chemistry, another Essenian Kabbalism, and the third Alexandrian Hermetism, the mysticism of the later Egyptians. From such fragments of the Rosicrucian lore as now exists, it is evident that the Brethren of the Rose Cross were especially addicted to these three forms of the ancient wisdom, and chose the symbols of these schools as the vehicles of their ideas. The technical task of decoding the hieroglyphics occurring throughout Latres Sainte Trinisophy was assigned to Dr. Edward C. Getzinger, an eminent authority on ancient alphabets and languages, who is now engaged in the decoding of the primitive ciphers in the Book of Genesis. A few words from his notes will give an idea of the difficulties involved in decoding. Archaic writings are usually in one system of letters or characters. But those among the ancients who were in possession of the sacred mysteries of life and certain secret astronomical cycles never trusted this knowledge to ordinary writing, but devised secret codes by which they concealed their wisdom from the unworthy. Each of these communities or brotherhoods of the enlightened devised its own code. About 3000 B.C. Only the initiates and their scribes could read and write. At that period the simpler methods of concealment were in vogue, one of which was to drop certain letters from words in such a manner that the remaining letters still formed a word which, however, conveyed an entirely different sense. As ages progressed, other systems were invented, until human ingenuity was taxed to the utmost in an endeavor to conceal and yet perpetuate sacred knowledge. In order to decipher ancient writings of a religious or philosophic nature, it is first necessary to discover the code or method of concealment used by the scribe. In all my 20 years of experience as a reader of archaic writings, I have never encountered such ingenious codes and methods of concealment as are found in this manuscript. In only a few instances are complete phrases written in the same alphabet, usually two or three forms of writing are employed, with letters written upside down, reversed, on with the text written backwards. Vowels are often omitted, and at times several letters are missing with merely dots to indicate their number. Every combination of hieroglyphics seemed hopeless at the beginning, yet, after hours of alphabetic dissection, one familiar word would appear. This gave a clue as to the language used, and established a place where word combination might begin, and then a sentence would gradually unfold. The various texts are written in Chaldean Hebrew, Ionic Greek, Arabic, Syriac, cuneiform, Greek hieroglyphics, and ideographs. The keynote throughout this material is that of the approach of the age when the leg of the grand man and the waterman of the zodiac shall meet in conjunction at the equinox and end a grand 400,000-year cycle. This points to a culmination of aeons, as mentioned in the Apocalypse, "Behold, I make a new heaven and a new earth," meaning a series of new cycles and a new humanity. The personage who gathered the material in this manuscript was indeed one whose spiritual understanding might be envied. He found these various texts in different parts of Europe, no doubt, and that he had a true knowledge of their import is proved by the fact that he attempted to conceal some 40 fragmentary ancient texts by scattering them within the lines of his own writing. Yet his own text does not appear to have any connection with these ancient writings. If a decipherer were to be guided by what this eminent scholar wrote, he would never decipher the mystery concealed within the cryptic words. There is a marvelous spiritual story written by this savant, and a more wonderful one he interwove within the pattern of his own narrative. The result is a story within a story. In the reprinting of the French text of the Trinisophia, the spelling and punctuation is according to the original. It has been impossible, however, to reproduce certain peculiarities of the calligraphy. In some cases the punctuation is obscure, accents are omitted, and dashes of varying lengths are inserted to fill out lines. The present manuscript is undoubtedly a copy, as Philotorm stated. The archaic characters and the hieroglyphics reveal minor imperfections of formation due to the copyist being unfamiliar with the alphabets employed. The considerable extent of the notes and commentaries has made it advisable to place them together at the end of the work rather than break up the continuity of the text by over-frequent interpolations. Latres Sainte Trinisophy is not a manuscript for the tyro. Only deep study and consideration will unravel the complicated skein of its symbolism. Although the text matter is treated with the utmost simplicity, every line is a profound enigma. Careful perusal of the book, and meditation upon its contents, will convince the scholar that it has been well designated the most precious known manuscript of occultism. by Manly P. Hall, Secret Friend of Franz Hartmann, Forgotten Mystical Adept. The secret friends to Franz Hartmann is truly forgotten, as even his, her name is completely lost to history. All that remains is the record given to Franz Hartmann from this forgotten mystic of this fascinating mystical journey. Franz Hartmann leaves us with only a few words to describe how he came upon the manuscript in question. The following account of a psychic experience has been gathered from notes handed to me by a friend, a writer of considerable repute. Whether the adventures told therein are to be regarded as a dream, or an actual experience on the astral plane, I must leave to the reader to judge. The experiences of this completely forgotten mystic speak for themselves and begin with a prayerful inquiry. Unexpected revelations. The adept paused, and my mind was invaded by a multitude of questions to which I could find no answer. What is nature, and what is man? Why am I in this world? Did I exist before, and, if so, where did I come from? What is the object of my existence, and how will it end? Again the adept, reading my thoughts, answered, "Mortal man, as you know him, is an intellectual animal, living a sort of dream, life among dream, pictures which he mistakes for realities. Real man is a celestial being, a soul dwelling temporarily within a material body. Within this organism a spiritual, divine spark finds the proper soil to generate and develop the immortal man, as has been described by Saint Paul, who speaks of that spark of divine consciousness as being sown in corruption and raised in incorruption. This spiritual man is in each person his or her personal God and Redeemer. While a man is unacquainted with the processes going on in his invisible organism, he will have little power to guide and control these processes. He will resemble a plant, which is dependent for its growth on the elements which are unconsciously brought to it by the winds and the rains, on which may accidentally be found in its surroundings. It has neither the power to prevent nor to promote its own growth. But when man obtains a knowledge of the constitution of his own soul, when he becomes conscious of the processes going on in its organism and learns to guide and control them, he will be able to command his own growth. He will become free to select or to reject the psychic influences which come within his sphere. He will become his own master and attain, so to say, psychic locomotion. He will then be as much superior to a man without such knowledge and power as an animal is superior to a plant. For while an animal may go in search of its food and select or reject what it pleases, the plant is chained to its place and depends entirely on the conditions which that one place affords. The ignorant depends on the conditions prepared for him. The wise can choose his conditions himself. And what will be the end and object of this? I asked. The end of it, was the answer, is that the soul of man enjoys supreme bliss in realizing that she herself is everything and that there is nothing beyond her. The object is that mortal man shall become immortal, and a perfect instrument for the manifestation of divine wisdom. I heard the answer of the master, but I could not grasp its meaning. What could that soul be of which he spoke as being as big as the universe, and could my soul possess any other vehicle or organism than my visible material body? While I was meditating, the adept stepped with me to a window where the inaccessible mountain was seen, and pointing it out to me, he said, "Behold there the door by which you entered our stronghold. Concentrate your attention upon the way you came, and seek with the eye of your soul to penetrate to the other side of the mountain." I did so, and suddenly I found myself standing at that other side, upon the place where I had lain down to rest. Before me, upon the ground, was stretched out an apparently lifeless human figure, and to my horror I recognized it as being my own bodily self. At first everything seemed a dream, but then the thought came to me that I must have died. There was my body, and nevertheless I was myself, and saw myself such as I had always been, with all my organs and limbs and even the same clothing which the corpse before me wore. The hat of the corpse was drawn over its eyes, and I attempted to lift it, but I might just as well have tried to lift the inaccessible mountain. There was no physical strength within my arms. I realized that my present body consisted of a state of matter differing from that of the physical plane. I thought I must have died, and a feeling of disgust came over me, thinking that I had ever inhabited that now lifeless, grossly material form. I was so glad to be free, and had no wish to re-enter it. But an inner voice seemed to speak to me, saying that the time of my laboring in the mundane sphere had not yet ended, and that I must return. I even felt a sort of pity for that helpless body, and the sympathy caused thereby created a strong attraction. I felt myself drawn towards that body, one who awakes from a dream. The adept stood by my side, and the vision was gone. "No, now, my friend," he said, "the difference between your physical and your psychical or astral organism. The divine soul has many vehicles through which it may act and manifest its powers." "But why," I asked, "are these things not recognized by academical science?" "On account of self, conceit," answered the adept. "The scientists, up to a very recent date, used to discard such questions as being unworthy of their consideration, and they preferred annihilation rather than confess that there was something in the wide expanse of nature which they did not already know. The theories advanced by the theologians were not more satisfactory than those of the scientists, for they believed, or professed to believe, that man was a complete being, in a finished state, with perfect freedom of will, and, as a punishment for his subsequent bad behavior, made a prisoner upon this planet. Furthermore, they were of the opinion that, if a man were leading a pious life, or, after leading a wicked life, obtained pardon for his sins and the favor of God, he would after his death become a celestial being, be ushered into a paradise, and live the forever in a state of never-ending enjoyment. It will be acknowledged now by every independent thinker, that these theories were not very satisfactory to those who desired to know the truth. But there was nothing either to prove or to contradict such assumptions, and, moreover, the multitude did not think, they paid their clergy to do their thinking for them. Since the publication of the secret doctrine, the opinions of the scientists and those of the theologians have been equally shaken to their foundations. The old truth which was known to the ancients, but which had been almost entirely forgotten during our modern age of materialism, that man is not a finished being, incapable of any further organic development, but that his body and his mind are continually subject to transformation and change, and that no transformation can take place where no substance exists, because force cannot exist without substance, has become almost universally known. It was demonstrated to the scientists that their science extended only to a very small portion of that mysterious being called man, that they only knew his outward appearance, his shell, but nothing of the living power acting within that mask which is called the physical body. It was demonstrated to the presumptuous theologians who believed that man's eternal welfare or damnation depended on their blessings or curses, that justice cannot be separated from God, and that man's salvation depends upon his own spiritual evolution. It was made logically comprehensible to the intellect that God in man will continue to live after all the lower and imperfect elements are dissolved, and that therefore a man in whom God did not exist in a state of divinity could not, after the death of his body, jump into a higher state for which he was not fit, and which he was not able to attain while alive. The exposition of the essential constitution of man, known to the Indian sages, described 300 years ago by Theophrastus Paracelsus, and again set forth more fully and clearly than ever before by H. P. Blavatsky and other theosophical writers, is calculated to humble the pride of the scientists and the vanity of the priests. When it is once more known and digested, it will prove to the learned how little they know, and it will draw the line for the legitimate activity of the clergyman as an instructor in morals. It proves that man is not already a god, as some had imagined themselves to be. It proves that he may look like an intellectual giant, and still be, spiritually considered, only a dwarf. It demonstrates that the law which governs the growth of organisms on the physical plane is not reversed when it acts upon the corresponding organisms on the psychical plane. It shows that out of nothing nothing can grow, but that wherever there is the germ of something, even if that germ is invisible, something may grow and develop. The growth of every germ and of every being, as far as we know it, depends on certain conditions. These conditions may be established either by means of the intellectual activity of the being itself, which has the power to surround itself by such conditions, or they may have been established by external causes, over which the being has no control. A plant or an animal cannot grow unless it receives the food and the stimulus which it requires. The intellect cannot expand unless it is fed with ideas and stimulated by reason to assimilate them. The soul cannot become strong unless she finds, in the lower principles, the nutriment required for the acquisition of strength, and is stimulated by the light of wisdom to select that which she requires. Here again the thought occurred to me, how agreeable and profitable it would be to live in such a Rosicrucian convent, where everything was rendered comfortable, no disturbing elements being admitted. To this the master answered, "One element necessary for the development of strength is resistance. If we enter one of the vast pine forests of the Alps, or of the Rocky Mountains in the United States, we find ourselves surrounded by towering trees, whose main trunks have very few branches. Upwards they rise like the masts of a ship, covered with a gray bark, naked, and without foliage. Only near the tops, that reach out of the shadows which they throw upon each other, the branches appear and spread up to the highest points, which wave their heads in the sunlight. These trees are all top, heavy. Their chiefly or only well developed parts are their heads, and all the life which they extract from the ground and the air seems to mount to their tops, while the trunks, although increasing in size as the tree grows, are left undeveloped and bare of branches. Thus they may stand and grow from year to year, and reach a mature age, but some day, sooner or later, some dark clouds collect around the snowy peaks and assume a threatening aspect, the gleam of lightnings appears among the swelling masses, the sound of thunder is heard, bolts of liquid light dart from the rents in the clouds, and suddenly the storm sweeps down from the summit into the valley. Then the work of devastation begins. These top, heavy trees, having but little strength in their feet, are mowed down by the wind like so many stems of straw in a field of wheat. There they lie rank after rank, having tumbled over each other in their fall, and their corpses encumber the mountain sides. But at the edge of the timber, and outside of the main body of the forest, looking like outposts or sentinels near the lines of a battle, there are still here and there some solitary pines to whom the storm could do no harm. They have, on account of their isolated positions, been exposed to winds all their lives, they have become used to it and grown strong. They have not been protected and sheltered by their neighbors. They are not top, heavy, for their great strong branches grow out from the trunk a few feet above the soil, continuing up to the tops, and their roots have grown through the crevices of the rocks, holding onto them with an iron grasp. They have met with resistance since the time of their youth, and, by resisting, have gained their strength. Thus intellectual man, growing up protected by fashion and friends in a school, college, university, or perhaps within the walls of the convent, finds himself isolated from contrary influences and meets with but little resistance. Crowded together with those who think like him, he lives and thinks like the others. Over their heads waves the banner of some accepted authority, and upon that banner are inscribed certain dogmas in which they believe without ever daring to doubt their veracity. There they grow, throwing upon each other the shadow of their ignorance, and each prevents the others from seeing the sunlight of truth. There they cram their brains with authorized opinions, learning details of our illusory life which they mistake for the real existence. They become top, heavy. For all the energy which they receive from the universal fountain of life goes to supply the brain, the soul is left without supply, the strength of character, of which the heart is the seat, suffers, the intellect is overfed and the spirit is starved. Thus they may grow up and become proud of their knowledge, but perhaps someday new and strange ideas appear on the mental horizon, a wind begins to blow, and down tumbles the banner upon which their dogmas have been inscribed, and their pride tumbles down with it. But not only on the physical and the intellectual plane, in the realm of the emotions, too, the same law prevails. He who desires to develop strength must not be afraid of resistance, he must obtain strength in his feet. He must be prepared to meet the wind of the lower emotions, and not be overthrown when the storms of passion arise. He should force himself to remain in contact with that which is not according to his taste, and even to harmonies with that which appears inimical, for it is really his friend, because it can supply him with strength. He should learn to bear calumny and animosity, envy and opposition. He should learn to endure suffering, and to estimate life at its true value.